From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a commissioner from one of Michigan's hardest-hit counties talks about balancing public health and the economy.
I think we should all, 83 of us, stick together and look out for each other's concerns. We can't allow this economic tsunami to carry on much longer. People will be ruined.
Eileen Kowal is our guest this hour. Also, an inmate at Lakeland Correctional Facility tries to stay healthy in a population testing 50% positive for COVID-19.
It wasn't until the tests were administered last week that they were able to get a grip on what was actually going on. So before then, they were pretty much flying blind.
And one poet reflects on this moment in Detroit history.
Detroit being hit the way we have in the Black community, I just don't think other people, after talking to my friends in other states and cities, understood the weight of what was happening here.
And yet, she notes the city endures. Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Physical distancing is absolutely essential to stopping the spread of COVID-19. In a prison, it's nearly impossible. Later this hour, we'll hear from a man serving time at a Coldwater State prison about what it's like to watch the outbreak unfold from inside prison walls. But first, as you're dealing with all of the things you're dealing with right now, your first thought may not be to take your problems to county government. But Michigan's counties are playing a critical role in the public health response to COVID-19, tracking cases, monitoring outbreaks, and that's putting a strain on already tight county budgets. Here with us to discuss is Eileen Kowal, a commissioner in Oakland County and a former state legislator. Her county has been one of the hot spots for COVID-19. Eileen, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, and you couldn't have said it better that counties are where the rubber hits the road. We're on the front lines of dealing with public health, and we find ourselves in a really unique position right now, being squeezed between what will probably be falling revenues and actually increased service needs.
Counties depend, as we mentioned, on revenue sharing from the state. And that model was something of a hot topic before COVID. What is happening with the financial model in counties like Oakland County right now?
Well, we just recently, I'd say probably about maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I guess that's started to come back online with the revenue sharing after we were, the governor at the time, Governor Granholm, did the pull forward of the county collection of taxes to create funds for us to replace the revenue sharing. So we were getting revenue sharing back from the state, but now since that's based on sales tax, that's going to impact that hugely. And counties, unlike local units of government, do not get constitutional revenue sharing with the counties. We are on a statutory basis, so it's more discretionary as to whether or not or how much they pay us in revenue sharing.
What does the shortage mean in a county that's been hit so hard by the virus?
Well, it means a lot. We've been spending so much funds for the COVID response, you know, with masks, PPEs, the testing that's going on, the mobilization of forces supporting hospitals. And we are getting reimbursed for those costs, about 70 to 75% of those costs. But we are still going to be in a position where we are going to find ourselves lacking revenues because of what I said about revenue sharing, as well as the fact that I think somewhere around 60% of our funds come from property taxes. And although we don't see a fall in property values just yet, and hoping not, it could be quite possible that people would be unable to pay their property taxes for some time in the foreseeable future. So we're going to have that constraint coming down on us as well.
Yeah, we've heard in the past 24 hours that your neighbor Wayne County has announced a hiring freeze and a pay freeze, partly because of the uncertainty of the financial situation. Have things gotten that bad in Oakland County?
We did institute a hiring freeze with a few caveats in there for essential people for the COVID response. We did our administration immediately upon the emergency powers did issue a hazard pay to essential county employees of 1.5 times pay. And right now we are going to be asked, I believe, Wednesday evening at our virtual board meeting to extend the emergency powers once again for probably another couple of weeks, I'm thinking. So we are watching everything. I'm a fiscal conservative. I'm very concerned about how the money is being spent and validating and keeping good track of it, having a rationale for it. I'm also, as a fiscal conservative, going to say that I'm hoping that Congress and the White House can work together to come up with some funding to possibly help us with the fall in our actual finances, to give us more flexibility to deal with dealing with revenue shortfalls with guardrails on, of course. I mean, it would have to have a lot of guidelines in place, but these are unprecedented times. So I don't see how we can possibly, even with great reserves that we have, the reserves cannot make up the difference.
It feels like a lot of the rhetoric around how the COVID response is being handled is starting to break along demographic lines. How do you respond when you hear someone saying, this disease is your county's problem? You know, you're the one with the high numbers. It's not my county's problem.
I haven't heard that.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Well, only to say, you know, there are some elected officials and some people from other places in Michigan who feel like they haven't seen the high number of confirmed cases in their own counties, and yet they see their own businesses subject to some kinds of constraints. And they're saying that the priority right now needs to be getting Michigan's business back open, getting back to work. How do you view tensions that may be developing between people who say the economy needs to reopen and the deep need to get on top of the virus and keep flattening the curve?
Well, to your first point about the varying counties, I'm actually speaking for all Michigan counties today. I'm a member of the Michigan Association of Counties Board of Directors, and there's 83 of us counties. And while Oakland is getting direct funding from the federal government, the smaller counties are certainly not, and they have their needs as well. So I think we should all, 83 of us, stick together and look out for each other's concerns. I do agree with you as well that we should be looking at, and we introduced a resolution at the last virtual board meeting about opening Oakland County back up, gearing up plans. They have developed a task force to deal with that. And we need to be looking at ways, and I'm not sure that maybe, I know they posed it essential. Everything was based on essential initially. But I think now the conversation needs to be around what can we do safely? Mm-hmm. Because everybody's business is essential to them. And we can't allow this economic tsunami to carry on much longer. People will be ruined. So we really need to look at getting people back to work, companies back up in a safe manner. And I think that can be done.
What kinds of things are on your mind when you start to think about what it would look like to reopen business in Oakland County?
Well, right now I'm glad to have my lawn care guy out mowing my lawn as we speak.
Right.
But I think that every different business, and I've been talking to whether they're manufacturing or whatever kind of business, they are making plans according to their business and what their particular challenges are as to how they can handle bringing people back in safely. But I think it has to be individualized. I think there's been all along, there's been too many broad brushstrokes taken as to what's an essential business, what's not. So we need to look at each situation individually.
As you referred to, the National Association of Counties is calling on Congress and the White House to make sure that counties receive their share of federal funding as the effort to deal with COVID-19 continues. What can you tell us about the emergency aid that's been made available and maybe what you see being a priority in the weeks to come?
Well, we are grateful for the help that we've received in many from the Paycheck Protection Program and the several care packages that have passed. They've certainly been instrumental in providing funding for hospitals and healthcare providers and state and local governments to scale up to local COVID-19 testing capacity. And with $225 million for rural health clinics, support for small businesses that help our economies. So we are grateful for that. But what we are looking for is to have something that has more resources as we address this unprecedented pandemic. And we're looking for more direct, flexible funding for our counties. Once again, as I said, with guardrails in place, we're all well aware that this certainly is not helping our national debt right now, but we need to survive this pandemic and this storm before we can start returning to normal and righting our economy and our finances again.
County work is very often one of those things that people don't notice unless it isn't there. How would you say that your view of the job has changed at all as the county and the entire state has dealt with the pandemic?
Maybe a little bit, but I've always realized that, you know, that we as counties carry out many state and federally funded mandates, and we are closer to the people than, say, state or obviously federal. But the pandemic, I think, has brought that more in line. You know, I've had actually outreach from several people who were having trouble with their Michigan unemployment, and I've tried to steer them and direct them as best as I can. And of course, I'm there for people that, you know, have questions or concerns, or they're just plain frightened about what's going on. So we've been kind of invisible, like you said. I think people are becoming much more aware of the fact that we are an intermediary that can really serve their needs.
What can you tell us about the pace of the infection in Oakland County as we're having this conversation?
Well, it is slowing down, and we are constantly looking for, you know, testing methods, testing kits, so we can detect more people or decide who's safe to go back to work or whatever. So we're seeing the numbers declining, leery, of course, of having them jump back up again. But it has taken everybody together to create an all-out effort to get us to where we are right now.
Eileen Kowal is an Oakland County Commissioner. Eileen, thank you very, very much for your time today.
Thank you very much, too. You take care.
You too. Still to come, poet and playwright Jessica Kerr Moore on the resilience and innovation of Black Detroiters in the midst of the pandemic. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. It's pretty easy to get sandbagged by the enormity of what's happening right now, especially in Detroit, where multiple members of one family may be sick with COVID-19. Longtime friends and colleagues are claimed day after day. And on some days, even the youngest and strongest among us aren't safe. But one Detroit writer would put this to you in a slightly different way. Maybe the nature of Detroit is to find a way through such things. Jessica Kerr Moore is a poet, a playwright, an artist, and producer. She recently published an op-ed for the Detroit Free Press whose title begins, "Detroiters Have Always Fought to Survive." Jessica Kerr Moore, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
This beautiful essay that you wrote nods to Detroit's history as an engine of innovation, with some very specific things to say about the role that Blackness has played in that innovation.
I mean, this, you know, I grew up in Detroit, born and raised here, grew up on the West Side, right on the Ward and Tyerman on the border of Dearborn, went to St. Al's in Dearborn, and then off to Cody High School for high school. And so I love this place. And my father was a very strong entity. He had his own construction company. And I was raised by blue collar working parents, working class parents. And the thing that's interesting about, you know, I have so many friends. Being an artist, you know people everywhere. So my friends in New York, you know, who have been sick, and my friends in Georgia who have been sick and fighting, and my friends in California. And so, but Detroit specifically being hit the way we have in the Black community. And I just don't think other people, after talking to my friends in other states and cities, understood the weight of what was happening here. You know, I was on Facebook, and Brandon Williams, who's a great drummer here, said that he knew 40 people that were dead. 40, you know what I mean? And so, and I haven't started doing my numbers, but it's probably you know, at least about 25 to 30 around the country that are gone. People that I know, yeah, for sure, you know. And then if it's not people that I know, it's my friends. My friends have lost parents. My friend, my publicist, Biba, you know, God bless her, lost her mother, grandmother, and her aunt, like within 3 weeks. And so, you know, my best friend Charlotte lost her sister, who I mentioned in the article, Maria, who I've known my whole life, mm-hmm, since I was about 12. And so it's, you know, because so family is not just, you know, your blood relatives. You know, I'm blessed that my siblings, my blood siblings and my mother are fine here in Detroit. But, you know, the people that I love and consider family outside of my household and the people I grew up with are hurting dearly. And we just lost Mike Huckabee. You know, Mike Huckabee, I traveled to Wolfsburg, Germany with him. And we did a thing called Learning from Detroit. And it's to me very symbolic to what will happen, I think, once this is over, and God willing, it will be sooner than later, is that people will be looking at Detroit to see what has happened here in our community and why, what are the reasons, you know, this community was affected, not just by getting COVID-19, but not surviving it.
Yeah. For those who hadn't had the pleasure, Mike Huckabee was a DJ who was deeply, deeply involved in the community and a great artist in his own right. What parallels came to your mind about the things that Detroit has survived in the past and what is here and now?
I mean, you know, we've survived Ronald Reagan in the 80s invasion of that. We've survived, you know, crack cocaine. We've survived extreme plant closures that took families that were upper, more like middle class families into poverty in some families, mm-hmm, or lower working class. And so, but I know that, you know, this is a strong town, you know, and we do, this place created the Black middle class in the country. We have homeowners, and you know, I moved back here after 12 years of being away in New York and Atlanta. And I saw, you know, my friends, family members houses I've been going to since I was a little girl, people were walking away from houses, losing their homes. And so here we are again in a space where everyone's, myself included, I own a home here in Detroit, worried about how to pay the mortgage. And even if the mortgage company's giving you a break for a couple of months, where is the money after the few months if you aren't working?
Well, what does self-reliance look like to you in this moment?
You know, just not allowing myself to cave in. Like the first week or two, the first call I got, my friend Nikki Barksdale, my childhood friend, had passed away. And so, and the next day, my friend Marlo Stoudemire. And so I couldn't write. I wanted to just stay in the bed and I wanted to just cry. And I thought I deserved that. And at some point, and now with that, I'm online every day, sharing my work, doing my poetry. My book came out March 31st on HarperCollins. I had to pull myself together and know that I had to be here for the living and that I had to continue to somehow connect with audience, because audience needs art more than ever now. I know I'm listening for them DJs. I'm tapping into literary events. I want to hear from poets. I want to hear music. I want to be inspired. I want a distraction from the noise. And I realized that I had to be that person. Like, as much as, you know, I'm busy. I have a 13-year-old now that's home with me. He's in private school. So he is in school, you know, full-time on Google Classroom. He does actually still have instruction, unlike so many of our Detroit public school kids who don't. And I'm glad they're working on that. But, you know, just as a mother, you know, I have to pull it together for my kid so that I can't fall. I don't have the option of falling apart as much as I want to. And I still might. But in the meantime, writing this article, writing poetry, I've written a series of isolation poems that I'm enjoying it's just for myself, just to get me through the day. But that self-determination, at some point you have to, and I'm literally on, I really have a virtual tour. I have an Instagram show now on Tuesdays at 7, where I'm bringing other artists on. Omar Reagan comes on tonight with Mahogany Jones. Omar Reagan's a activist and comedian that travels all over the world, but he's raising money for food during Ramadan, feeding the fast, he calls it. And Mahogany Jones, who's a great MC and artist. So I'm just trying to be a conduit or not just myself, but to like connect all these incredible artists that I know and people I know, to bring them, give them some space so they can talk. Because even moments like this, just talking to you on Michigan Radio, like all of it feeds me. As much as I'm like, oh my God, I'm so tired of being online. I'm so zoomed out.
Yeah.
at the same time, I feel good after being able to share, and it makes you feel less lonely. You know,
you even find in this essay some beats that say things about the isolation and context for that. I'm just going to read a little bit of it. The children of the Up South movement who built engines, ate southern seasoned collard greens, and learned to nurse urban gardens before it became a thing. We are generally one generation away from Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia, which means we are unapologetically Black. And despite our growing skyline, we are quite country.
It's with a K.
I know. It's such a different read about physical distance and isolation right now.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we are definitely Southern people. And I think that's speaks to what's happening with COVID-19, because people are like, how do you know so many people that have passed? I was like, this is Alabama. Everybody knows everybody here. You know, I'm one out of three Black people. I kind of know them. If I don't know them, then my cousin knows them, or a friend knows them. Everyone, the community is smaller than we realize here, right? We're, large in some ways compared to other cities. But when it comes to Black community, especially like the Black artist community, we all know each other. All the writers and the musicians and the painters, you know, it's just impossible not to know each other. And then the politicians, and I just end up knowing everybody. And so that's what that is, though, that very Southern hospitality, Southern growing up, like, you know, griot information gets passed through, misinformation gets passed through, whatever, but it does pass through. But, you know, my daddy's from Madison, Alabama, which is a small town inside of Huntsville. And so that very Southern way of communicating is real here. And there's a lot of miscommunication early in the Black community about Black people not being able to get COVID-19, which is ridiculous, you know? And I'm like, no, that's not the truth. The COVID-19, everybody can get it. Everyone can die from it. But we really have to think about, and I talk about those Southern greens, which is great Southern food, but really thinking about as a community, what we need to be doing to make sure our kitchens are our medicine cabinets. You know, poor people need organic food. Poor and working class people, children deserve good fruit and vegetables and healthy stuff, not drive-through windows, which stayed open. And I was like, you can close those up, because there's no way in hell we're going to the drive-through to feed us during the pandemic while this is something attacking their respiratory system. Do you think we need a burger and fries from McDonald's? No.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jessica Kerr Moore. She's a poet, artist, and producer based in Detroit. Well, as you mentioned, you are taking care of your son right now and home with him every day.
Yeah.
How is he holding up?
He's driving me nuts. So he's just fine. I mean, you know, he's talking to his friends more than I want him to. Trying to balance it out. We've done a couple of days of yoga, mommy and son yoga. You know, we're trying different things. He's good. He plays piano, so he's here on his piano, and he's good. I mean, I'm okay, so he's okay.
Yeah.
And I think that's what it is. If I was in here, you're not cooking him all this food. All I'm doing is cooking, you know, all the moms. Oh my God, God bless the chefs, because I'm a personal chef. And I never had to cook this much, you know, because normally, you know, it's a breakfast out the door, go to school, pack a lunch. And now it's like, you know, he's hungry all the time. And it's just because he's in the house bored. But he's okay. I mean, he's frustrated. I mean, and that's what inspired the beginning of the article, was his friends whose pictures are there, Kingston and Donovan, my neighbors who are lovely, who live right across the street. And they were like, well, we want to play. And so he was outside with this mask on, across, looking at his friends across the street. And he was like, I want to go back in the house. And he was like, what is the point of me being out here?
Right.
And I was like, okay, King, you know, I understand. This got to suck for you. This got to suck for 13-year-old. He's in eighth grade. So, you know, there's no eighth grade dance. There's no, at least they got their trip into D.C., but everything else is gone. And hopefully we'll have some kind of a graduation ceremony for them, maybe in late summer. But, you know, so I'm having to, as a mom, give in to allowing you know, things, staying up a little later at night than normal, you know, but his grades are fantastic online. They're better online than they were when he was in school. So he's very focused because he's home with me.
Do you think that this is more difficult for him as a, you know, someone who is in his own right, you know, something of an artist and trying to express himself? Or do you think it's harder for him just as a kid taking all this in?
I think just as a kid, he misses his friends. So it's been difficult. They're having like Netflix movie parties together and staying active on the phone, which is helping. But I know that he's sick of me. Probably, poor thing. Like, you know,
Many households experiencing this phenomenon right now.
Yeah, he's probably like, you know, and though, you know, there's some things that I'm doing with him that he needed to. We have taken the opportunity to learn how to cook some food. So, you know, mommy is teaching, like, so that he can become more independent. We had a big discussion about that this morning, so that I'm not breakfast, lunch, and dinner, so that you can make yourself breakfast. You can make pancakes. So teaching him how to make himself some things so that he can become more independent during times like this. But it's not easy. I mean, I told him to write about it. I mean, he hasn't yet, but before Thursday, I'm hoping that he'll write a piece about being in isolation. But my son is resilient. He's a pretty resilient kid, and he's very, very, like, I don't know. He's just kind of self-efficient, and I'm glad he's not really needy with me. I'm alive. King is healthy. I'm healthy. You know, my family's healthy. Like, that's the thing that keeps me going, and knowing that this is just a moment in time. It's not the thing that's going to hopefully define the entire year. I really pray that 2020 doesn't just become a blur and this horrible thing that just took beautiful people out with no light.
Jessica Care Moore, this grounding of history is the thread that connects the poem we just heard and the essay that you published recently. Yeah. You know, some people have looked at the history and looked at what's happening to Black families right now and all the disparities that have poured gasoline on the fire of the new coronavirus and have said, you know, this is not unrelated. Everything is all connected. But has it been difficult for you to keep sight of the resilience even as you see the history and everything that has been laid bare by this outbreak?
I mean, no. I mean, we're resilient people. You know, that's why we're still here. You know, we are, you know, the children of indigenous ancestors who were on this land first. We are deeply connected to the transatlantic slave trade. Many of our folks, you know, who fought to their way out of slavery, fought their way out of freedom so they can become people like Frederick Douglass. You know, I keep those ancestors close to me, even ones who are younger, you know, like James Baldwin, you know, people who really fought for what was right in this country. And so we can't stop now. You know, it's not because of a pandemic happened. I mean, the Black community in this country has been under the rock for way too long for what we've contributed to the country, from inventions to science to the medical profession to the frontline workers right now, who many of them are Black women, the nurses that I know. My friend Dr. Rob Gore, is an emergency medical doctor in Brooklyn, who's working now while his wife is pregnant. And having to be away from his wife so that he can help other people, you know, live. And so this is, you know, the heart and soul of who we are. And so we have to remain that, because that's why we survived. And that's why I exist, is because someone, great-great-grandmothers and fathers, they stayed alive.
Is it difficult as an artist right now to be in a place where you have to be that much more immediate with your work, and some of the consideration and some of the, I guess, self-curation is just not coming into play right now because everything is so, top volume and high speed?
Yeah, my issue is only that I'm not getting paid for my appearances the way I'm used to. And so I spoke to a couple of different friends of mine. They're like, yeah, I feel like I'm working more online than I was working offline, but not getting paid a third of what I usually get. And so that's the issue, is that so much everyone kind of rushed to get online. And like, how do you compete with all the free stuff when I need to, I have a workshop masterclass that begins on Thursday. That's just $100 a week. But, you know, getting people to sign up for something for $100 a week for 4 weeks isn't easy right now.
Especially right? when there's rent to pay.
There's rent to pay. I can't even do it. I'm bummed that I can't go out and read. Like when I get to read a poem in front of an audience and not a computer screen, I'm going to probably cry because I'm just, my eyes hurt from having to be in front of this laptop so much or on my phone. But you know, again, it's what we're just doing, what we're supposed to do until we get to the finish line of this thing. And it's just a different way of approaching my art. I am writing. I wasn't writing, but I began writing. And the writing has helped me feel like I have some other purpose. And it's very reflective time, you know. And some days I just like lounge on the couch and look at movies and give myself permission to do that too, you know, to take a break.
If we can't do that, I don't know where that leaves us. Well, Jessica Caremore, thank you so much for talking with us. Her latest book of poetry is We Want Our Bodies Back. And you can read her recent op-ed piece in the Detroit Free Press. We hope very much to see you in person on the flip side.
Thank you. See you soon.
In other news, we're following more than half the inmates at a Michigan prison have tested positive for COVID-19. Coming up, we'll talk with an inmate at that prison about the situation. That's after a short break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Inmates at Michigan's correctional facilities fear for their health and safety as more and more people inside prison walls test positive for the coronavirus. Many have died. Efren Paredes Jr. is one of those inmates. He's a longtime advocate for prison reform. Sentenced to life in prison when he was a teenager, his case was being reconsidered this year because of a Supreme Court ruling that states sentencing minors to life in prison without a chance of parole is unconstitutional. But the process has slowed down considerably as the courts and Lakeland Correctional Facility itself have gone into lockdown because of COVID-19. More than half of Lakeland's inmates have tested positive for the virus. Before we start this interview, we should mention Lakeland includes two different rescue dog training programs. So if you hear some barking, that's who's doing it. Efren Paredes, how are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. I'm hanging in there and I'm doing the best that I can, you know, given everything that's going on here at the facility.
All the prisoners at Lakeland, including yourself, have now been tested for COVID-19. I mean, that just happened last week. We've been hearing that more than 50% of Lakeland's population has tested positive. Have you been able to get your results yet?
Yes, I have. As of this morning, 9:30, the last time that I had someone check the numbers, 785 cases out of 1,400 have tested positive here at Lakeland, which is 57%.
Wow.
We represent 58% of all the infections statewide in every Michigan prison. I received the results of my tests on Friday, and I was one of the fortunate ones to have tested negative.
We're glad to hear it. How would you say the physical distance that you maintain on a daily basis is in terms of just where guys spend their days? Is it possible to get away from others physically?
The only time that people can really get away from others is when they go outdoors, inside of the housing units and inside any building for that matter, whether it's an educational building or recreation room or any other building. People are always close to one another. In those buildings, most of the time, people are, shoulder to shoulder. You know, they're having to get out of each other's way, you know, to get down hallways. Or there's multiple people using the bathroom area at one time because it's a community bathroom, you know, for 80 people. So it's very difficult. It's very difficult, which is one of the major contributions to why so many people have contracted COVID-19 at this prison.
Is it necessarily obvious how many people are sick right now?
Well, the way that they have, what they've done is they've started to separate people into housing units that have been designated specifically for people who have tested positive, and there are some housing units designated for the ones that have tested negative. The problem with that is that there's been that process has been a bungled process. There have been people that were sent to the positive housing unit when they were negative, and just today, you know, we learned that one of the people that had been living in our housing unit, the negative housing unit, had been positive since last week, and he was still in the housing unit.
Do you feel like the people who are visibly showing symptoms are being moved out of the general population in a timely way?
Now people are. For 4 weeks, people complained of symptoms. And if they didn't have a fever, they were just sent back to the housing unit. And if they were infected, you know, that would have allowed propagation of the disease. So for weeks, it wasn't until the tests were administered last week, the robust testing, that they were able to get a grip on what was actually going on. So before then, they were pretty much flying blind, trying to get, you know, mitigate and contain this pandemic here.
Yeah. Efren, can you tell us a little bit about how meals work at Lakeland? I mean, generally meals are served cafeteria style. Has that continued through as people have started getting sick?
For weeks, I and others on the outside have been advocating for the cafeteria to be closed. We were being fed in crowded dining area where about 150 people were eating at a time, four people at three-foot tables, square tables. So it was impossible to practice social distancing. That greatly contributed to the spread of the virus. And it wasn't until 200 people contracted COVID-19 and nine people died here that the facility finally stopped feeding people in the dining hall and began delivering packaged meals to the housing units. Because people were deathly afraid of going to eat in the dining hall every day when they knew that people who worked in the dining hall had tested positive for COVID-19, that food service supervisors had tested positive, and the virus was thriving inside that space. 1,300 people were filing into and out of that space three times a day, and we knew it was dangerous to eat in there. So people have felt a sense of relief of not having being forced to go back over there and eat during this crisis. The thing is going to be, what happens, you know, weeks from now when things start to calm down? Because, you know, the virus is going to return again. You know, the scientists are saying it's going to return in the fall, and it's probably going to be even deadlier than it is right now. That's a deep concern, you know, moving forward.
All inmates at the prison have been tested for COVID-19. More than half have tested positive for the virus. Efren's results came back negative. You know, I was just going to ask, there's so many inmates who've been sick. Do you know anyone who was very sick suffering from COVID-19?
I do. I know a lot of people. You know, it was heartbreaking to see so many people. That was one of the things that really bothered me is Friday when I received my test results, just to see how many other people were being tested, you know, given and told that they were positive. I've known some people that we've grown up in prison together. You know, I've been here for 31 years. I've been incarcerated since I was 15 years old. And there's other people that have been incarcerated, you know, as long as me, who are juvenile lifers, people who are sentenced to life without parole when they were kids. And some of those people have tested positive.
Is it pretty common knowledge when someone dies? Is that information released to the rest of the population?
It is kind of it is released, but it's not being released right away. Maybe within a couple of days, but they don't tell us who the names of the people are. Usually, we hear it, you know, through staff members or people who were in contact with family members of the person who may have died.
That sounds very hard.
It is extremely hard because, you know, there are people that have been here for decades, you know, waiting for an opportunity to become a productive citizen again and go back out into the community. And then, you know, there was a gentleman who was a juvenile lifer, you know. He died a couple weeks ago just waiting to go home. He was going to go home next month. He served 43 years and then died while waiting to go home.
Do you know anyone who has, I mean, obviously the virus is having just a catastrophic effect in some communities across Michigan. Do you know anyone who's lost someone on the outside?
We know several people. You know, one of the things about the prison system is that there's a large population from Wayne County, you know, people that lived in Detroit. So a lot of their family members, you know, a lot of people have had family members who have succumbed to the virus.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking today with Efren Paredes Jr. He's an inmate at Lakeland Correctional Facility. Your case was subject to review this year. As you mentioned, you were sentenced to life in prison as a juvenile. And there's a lot of information online at your website about the case and the arguments that advocates have put forward on your behalf. And there were a lot of people who had hoped that this was going to be the year for you. What's the situation with your appeal as of today?
So in 2012, the U.S. Supreme Court made a ruling that stating that mandatory life without parole sentences are unconstitutional for juvenile offenders. So we've been waiting for 8 years to get a ruling. There were 363 people here in Michigan who were impacted by that ruling. 170 of them have been resentenced, and 190 of us are still waiting. I should have been back to court long before now. The, you know, prosecutors across the state have just been continually delaying the process. And recently, I became part of a class action lawsuit against the state of Michigan in February, calling on the federal court, asking them to expedite this process because it's gone on so long. So if, you know, if that goes well, you know, hopefully I can be resentenced sometime this summer or maybe in the fall. But that's, you know, it's been a grueling, agonizing process, waiting 8 years to be resentenced and to be sitting in prison without a sentence.
We know that an awful lot of Michigan's court functions have been brought to a halt. And are you hearing anything about when those will be restarted?
No. I think it's everything is kind of day to day. You know, it's a very fluid situation. We don't know, you know, what's happening. We hear about, you know, the government opening up, you know, different sectors at a time, you know. But, you know, the last I heard that there was, you know, a couple people who had tested positive working in the federal White House. I mean, working in the federal court for the Eastern District of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had suspended hearings there for, you know, some time.
You've spent a lot of time working on a petition campaign for prison reform. And this is a time in Michigan when the state has decided to release a limited number of people early because of the outbreak. Some federal inmates have been eligible for an early parole or an early release. It feels like it has the possibility for a moment of reckoning about who absolutely does need to be incarcerated because they present a danger to society and who does not. Do you think that this might be a moment when people will think about how our prisons fit or don't fit with society's goals for justice?
I certainly hope it does. You know, we drafted that 10-point platform. That was before the COVID crisis even began. We added in a clause in there regarding the COVID crisis once it started. What this has exposed, I think, COVID-19 is how dangerous prisons are to public safety. They're a public health risk. They're a human rights catastrophe. You know, we have things like COVID-19 ravaging the prisons, and there's nothing that can be done to social distance, you know, allow people to social distance. And so, you know, moving forward, we need to think about what it is we're looking at when it comes to punishment. Because one of the things that's been proven through studies is that long-term incarceration does not deter crime. So, you know, there's a lot of people that could be released that are in prison right now. We could do some better with sentencing, you know, reforming sentencing guidelines. We could do something with ending mandatory minimums. People are serving way too much time. Right now, Michigan people are incarcerated longer than any other state in the country.
At the same time, you've pointed out in your writing there's these big discrepancies between how Michigan spends a lot of money on prisons, even as crime from a generational standpoint has been decreasing, At the same time, it's been really tough to get political will to make these changes. What do you think is essential to changing people's minds and people's math about what role prisons serve and what they do?
Education, a lot of education and activism. You know, a lot of people have been looking at prison in terms of, you know, through the lens of, you know, get tough on crime and, you know, through, you know, allowing politicians to instill fear in the public while the numbers have gone down. You know, juvenile crime specifically has gone down for like 15 to 20 years. And the only thing that's increased when it comes to crime is the coverage of crime through the lens of the media. And so when people begin to understand that, look, you know, we have people in here that are serving a long sentences. We look at, for instance, we look at people who are serving life without parole sentences. The recidivism rate for those people is less than 1%. Recidivism rate for people serving parolable life sentences is less than 2%. Yet these are the populations that we continue to keep incarcerated for as long as possible. And that just doesn't make any sense. We have to do better. We have to look at how the rest of the world is able to solve this problem without using incarceration as their main instrument of social control.
You know, I don't mean to sound cynical, but as the state's revenues have been plunging during the outbreak, I can't help but wonder if finances might even drive some of this for the state.
Well, I certainly believe that when people have a choice between keeping people incarcerated just because they're angry at them and sacrificing all the things that means with the budget, the way that this crisis is cratering the budget. And what I mean by that is when they start looking at, you know, do I want food on my table? Do I want, you know, schools to stay open? Do I want first responders to get paid? Those things take precedence over making sure that we get the most time out of someone, you know, placed inside of a human cage. And we have to think about that. We have to think realistic about this. And we need to think sensibly and humanely.
I know you don't have much choice in your situation right now, but I was wondering how you feel like you're getting through this. What keeps you going?
My faith, you know, my belief in a higher power, my family, you know, knowing that I can communicate with them and knowing that they're safe and hanging in there, that they're doing well. That means the world, you know, to me. Hearing from friends and family has been an enormous help. Staying busy, you know, reading and writing, meditating, working on breathing exercises, and, you know, trying to stay as focused as, you know, as I can. Trying to think about the things that I do have control over and not try to focus on the things that I don't have control over during this difficult moment. But one thing that I did want to mention is that the people who have been tested positive for COVID-19 are not receiving therapeutic treatment. We were told before this crisis began that people who had contracted the disease would be given a regimen of vitamins, Theraflu, and Gatorade at a minimum. And the only thing that some of them have received is some vitamins, but the majority of them have not. And the other thing is that they're supposed to be getting visits by medical people from the healthcare services twice a day to check their oxygen saturation levels and their temperatures and to see how they're doing. That's not happening. They're doing it like in some units, and some units they're not. Some units they'll go one day, some units they won't go any days at all. It is really, really a disaster when it comes to that.
For those who don't know, oxygen saturation levels can be an important indicator in COVID patients about whether they're crashing and might be in need of a hospitalization or a more intensive level of care. Well, Efren, thank you so much for talking with us, and we hope you're able to stay safe through all this and see your family soon.
Thank you.
One final note, we reached out to Michigan's Department of Corrections for some response to this interview. As of broadcast time, no one's been made available to talk with us. That's That's our show for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks very much for listening. We'll catch you tomorrow.